Got to wake up, yeah. There's a guy in the back. But okay, well, it's the day before spring break, so we have a classroom packed with eager students this morning. So what I want to talk about today is minimum description length, and then we'll talk a little bit about how bias and variance play into estimation. And then we'll conclude with a couple techniques to deal with bias and variance issues. So minimum description length, we seek to design a classifier that minimizes the sum of the model's algorithmic complexity and the description of the training data D with respect to that model. And this is based on the concept of Kolmogorov complexity that we talked about briefly last class. So we can define this minimum description length as a function of H, the parameters of the model, and D, the training data, and we can write that as K of H, a function of the parameters of the model, plus K of D using H. In other words, how we describe the data given that particular model. Examples of minimum description length include measuring the complexity of a decision tree in terms of the number of nodes. We talked about that a couple lectures ago. Measuring the complexity of an HMM in terms of the number of states. People have tried things like training an HMM model to minimize the minimum description length so that, or to minimize the description length so that you end up with a model which has the least number of states possible for a certain level of performance. We can view MDL from a Bayesian perspective. We can write that the probability of the parameter set H given the data D can be written as the probability of the parameters times the probability of the data given the parameters divided by the probability of the data. The optimal hypothesis, H star, is the one yielding the highest posterior. H star would be argmax of the numerator since we can ignore the denominator in the optimization of H. And it's also often common to write this using logarithms so that we get essentially an expression which is related to the entropy or related to the number of bits. So we can write this as log 2 of P of H plus log 2 of P of D given H. And Shannon's optimal coding theorem provides a link between MDL and Bayesian methods by stating that the lower bound on the cost of transmitting a string X is proportional to log 2 P of X. So if you've had familiar with coding theory or you've had some exposure to that, you know that you can use run length encoding type techniques to minimize the number of bits required to transmit a string, and you arrange those bit patterns according to the probability distribution. And minimum description length kind of draws on that concept that it should be a minimal representation of the information. So we introduced this here just as an idea that it is possible to control the complexity of your learning machine, and the complexity is essentially H, or the number of parameters associated with your model. It's impossible to control that during training by minimizing functions like this. And as I said, people have in fact done that. Now, another sort of key concept, we've talked about algorithmic complexity. Another thing that we constantly worry about with pattern recognition systems is bias and variance. Two ways to measure the match of alignment of the learning algorithm to the classification problem involve bias and variance. Bias measures the accuracy in terms of distance from the true value of a parameter. High bias implies a poor match. We talked about this early on in the semester when we talked about the bias and variance of various maximum likelihood approaches to estimating the mean and variance of parameters of a Gaussian distribution. Variance measures the precision of a match in terms of the squared distance from the true value. High variance implies a weak match. So in general, we like to minimize, of course, bias and variance. But, and we'll see in a moment that the relationship between the biases and variance are obviously related, but they're related in a very complicated way. So for mean squared error, bias and variance are related. Consider these in the context of modeling data using regression analysis. Suppose there is an unknown function f of x, which we seek to estimate based on n samples in a set D drawn from f of x. So we have some function f of x, we have a data set D, and we want to estimate the function f of x by drawing n samples from that data set and doing some kind of parameter estimation. The regression function will be denoted by g of x and d. It's a function of x. It's dependent on the data d. And the mean squared error of this estimate can be written as the expectation of g of x and d give minus f of x, that quantity squared. And we showed a while ago that this can be written as the expectation of g of x and d minus f of x squared minus the expectation of g of x minus the expectation of g of x quantity squared. And this first term then is the bias, because this represents the basically the difference between these two. And the second term is the variance, because it's related, it's computing the square of the estimate minus the mean of the estimate. So this is known as the bias-variance trade-off, since more flexible classifiers tend to have lower bias but higher variance. So what we'll show in a moment is that these two are actually related, and it's very hard sometimes not to to minimize the bias and not impact the variance. So it's oftentimes we will look at the quality of a classifier in terms of its bias, but classifiers often will vary in the way they tackle variance. So an example of that is the EM algorithm, which will, in fact, very aggressively try to minimize the variance. And but for the moment, we just want to point out, really, that biases and variance are related, and it's possible to minimize bias but retain a high variance. And that's a characteristic of a number of classifiers. So let's look at this in a little more detail. Let's consider a two-category classification problem where we have our function f of x is going to be the probability of y. Remember, in our two-class problem, we have essentially a choice between 1 and 0, or 1 and minus 1. So we can write this as the probability of y being 1 given x, and that's simply the equal to 1 minus the probability of y being 0 given x. So we can consider a discriminant function y, which is this f of x plus some epsilon term which will represent a zero mean random variable. So epsilon is a zero mean random variable with the binomial distribution with variance f of x times 1 minus f of x. That can be shown, I think we actually showed that early in the semester when we dealt with a classification example involving binomially distributed data. But for now, we'll just take this on as a given. So the target function, then, this f of x can be represented as the expectation of y given x. And our goal, then, is to minimize the expectation of this discriminant function or our classification function g minus y quantity squared. Now, if we assume equal priors, the classification error rate can be shown to be. So the classification error rate is going to be essentially any time this g function does not equal the right value of y, we're going to get an error. And we can write that as by making use of these results, we can write this as the absolute value of 2 of f of x minus 1 times the probability that g is not equal to y plus the probability that y is not equal to, this y sub b is not equal to y, where y sub b is the Bayes discriminant, which in the case of a two-class problem with equal priors is equal to 1/2. Now, we're sort of skipping a lot of the derivation of this because that'll take us, I think, too far off course. But the key point here is that the classification error is linearly proportional to the probability that this function differs from the Bayes discriminant. And this can be considered a boundary error in that it represents the incorrect estimation of the optimal Bayes boundary. So if we have a two-class problem, we know that there's a optimal error rate, if you will, that you can get on that problem. There's the Bayes error rate, and the Bayes error rate can be computed using a Bayes discriminant. And the point here is that the classification error rate is going to be linearly proportional to that, our ability to estimate the Bayes error rate. So, if we assume that this probability of G of X and D is a Gaussian distribution, we can compute this error by integrating the tails of the distribution, and we can show that this probability of error is essentially this is a complementary error function of the argument is the sine of f of x minus 1/2. This is essentially when the optimal Bayes boundary is at 1/2. So when this f of x minus 1/2 is essentially measuring the distance from the optimal decision surface times the expectation of g minus 1/2 times the variance of this g of x and d raised to the minus 1/2 power. Now, the derivation of this is in the book, and it's rather long, so I don't want to go through the details of that. The main point that I want to make today, though, on this is that the key point here is that this first argument is proportional to the bias of the classifier. It's essentially if you look here, we have essentially the expectation of the classification is essentially the bias. And if this is equal to 1/2, then the bias is 0. If this is not equal to 1/2, the bias is not 0. And then it's also proportional to the variance. But we see that the variance and the bias and the variance are related in a nonlinear manner. For classification, the relationship is multiplicative. Typically, variance dominates the bias, and hence classifiers are designed to minimize variance. So this is, I think, an interesting observation in that as you look at, for example, the Bayesian techniques we've looked at, you'll notice we've shown these pictures of how as the estimate of the parameters of our model converges to the true value, not only does the peak of the distribution converge to the true value, but if you recall, the width of the distribution always gets sharper the closer you get to the true value. And this is essentially what's happening is that as with most of our estimators, they tend to be very confident that as they're converging to the true value, they really think that true value is right, is correct, and therefore they're essentially trying to minimize the variance. So, I think there's 5 people in here who are completely lost. So, when you design a classifier, you have some choices as to how that classifier converges to it's to the true values and such as a function of the number of data points. Now, that may not seem obvious to you, but in a theoretical sense, we can always derive properties of a classifier. We can always look at how the bias reduces as we increase the number of data points, the number of parameters, these kinds of things. We can look at how the variance of the estimate decreases. And in the early days of mean squared error estimators, there was a lot of work was done on trying to find and prove that there were estimation techniques that would give you less bias and less variance for the same number of data points. And then as people began to develop new learning machines that were probabilistically based, Bayesian and such, we can do the same kinds of things, only now we're going to have to deal with convergence in probability rather than convergence in mean squared error. And many of our, if you look at the theoretical properties of many of the classifiers we've talked about, things like support vector machines and neural networks and things like EM-based learning, you'll see that they essentially seek to minimize the variance. I mean, they're driving the variance to zero, and they try to drive it very quickly to zero, which is, you could say a good thing, except that if your training data set is not, the properties of your training data set are significantly different from the properties of your overall problem, you're going to end up with some bias because you're converging very sharply to the means and parameters required to model that specific data set so as you minimize variance, essentially, you better hope that you get the correct answer, because if you don't get the correct answer, you're going to have a large bias. So classifiers can be evaluated in terms of the way they trade off bias and variance. And in this section of the textbook, we try to look at that. Remember, we're in a general machine learning type scenario. So we try to look at that in a very general sense, not specific to an actual algorithm, to show that there is a relationship between bias and variance. And in most cases, it's a nonlinear relationship. So it's very difficult to reduce one without having an impact on the other. And since, as I said, variance tends to dominate bias, many classifiers can be viewed as classifiers which attempt to minimize variance rather than minimizing bias. So the implication of that is you can end up with a very small variance, but you can end up with a high bias. And that's not uncommon in situations where you have limited amounts of training data. Algorithms like EM are going to converge very sharply to what they think are the mean and, if you will, the mean and variance and such of that training data, that particular training data set. And because that training data set the properties of that training data set may differ from the overall training set because it's a finite set, you could have a bias that results. So we'll talk in a moment about techniques that we can create to try to mitigate those effects. But for the moment, let's just accept the fact that many of the classifiers we deal with will minimize variance at the expense of some bias. And there's more details on this in the textbook for the two-category problem. So how can we? So there are a couple issues that then come up. One is, and remember, the goal of this section of the course is not specific learning algorithms, but it's trying to understand the properties of learning algorithms in general. So if I give you a data set, a training data set, a very important question is, can we estimate the bias and variance of an estimation algorithm from that data. Are there some universal properties that we can conclude from that data set? Now, one of the obvious things we know about the data set is that for almost any classifier, the more data points you have, the better you expect your classifier to be when you're done training your classifier. And but let's see if we can actually go a little bit further than that. And we will show as an example of that if we actually manipulate the training data set by using subsets in various ways, and we'll talk in a moment about jackknifing and bootstrapping, that we can actually get some estimates of the bias and variance that we can achieve on that data set. And we can actually then, in some cases, reduce, improve our estimates by averaging across these different subsets. So suppose we have a set D of n data points, and we'll call those x sub I for I equals 1 to n. The estimates of the mean and sample variance, those are very easy to compute. We take all the data points, we sum them up, and that's our estimate of the mean. We take all the data points, take the sum of the squares minus the mean, and we can multiply by n minus 1 over n if we want an unbiased estimator of the sample variance. Now, what does it mean for, what does it mean when I talk about bias, what does that mean in terms of this estimate of the mean? So this is an estimator. This is an algorithm that estimates the mean, and we call that the sample mean, but it's an algorithm which estimates the sample mean of the data. What do we mean when we talk about bias with respect to that estimator? Right, so you've got some true value of your random process that's generating this data. You don't know what that is, but we can actually, as I mentioned last class, one of the ways we can actually play around with these kinds of concepts is to use simulated data, where we do in fact know the underlying statistics. So bias is simply the question, how far is this off from the true mean of the underlying distribution? And we've looked at that at several points throughout the semester, and we've actually derived relationships for the error in this estimate. And we showed that this estimate, the error between this and the true mean, will go to zero as n goes to infinity. The question that we're trying to address in a general way here is, are there different algorithms that for the same number of data points can estimate the mean more accurately than that equation? Now, give me an example. So we also know this estimate to be a maximum likelihood estimate, right? Right? We're really lost this morning. I'm just going to plow through these slides and we'll go home. But, it's getting to that point in the semester where things are starting to catch up. But this is a maximum likelihood estimate of the mean. What is wrong with it? What is potentially wrong with this estimate of the mean? If I give you n data points and you estimate the mean from those data points, the mean that you get will be different from the true mean of the underlying distribution that generated those data points. And we've spent some time this semester discussing why that's the case. This is a maximum likelihood estimate. What do we know about maximum likelihood estimates in terms of their statistical properties? What's the difference between a maximum likelihood estimate and a Bayesian estimate? include prior. So what does that mean in the context of this estimator? Okay, well, can you explain what that means in terms of the data itself? Why would we want to include priors in this estimate? Because we have to worry about how probable each of these data points are. If you draw a finite number of data points, there's a chance that that's a random sample. That sample may not reflect how probable each one of those data points are. You could have some extreme distribution where one of those data points has a probability of 0.999 and the rest of them have very small probabilities. And if this sample is not sufficiently large, that may not be reflected in the sample. So when you estimate the mean, you're going to get the wrong mean. And we talked about that. In fact, we talked about a Bayesian estimate. If we have knowledge about the priors, how we can actually mix the maximum likelihood estimate and the Bayesian estimate, so that in the limit, as n goes to infinity, the maximum likelihood estimate will converge to the true estimate, because then you've got enough samples of the data to properly reflect the prior statistics of the process. But when the data set is small, you will be off, and you can do better. This is what Bayesian analysis is all about. You can do better if you take into account prior information. So one of the things we're concerned about in this course is, are there better ways to estimate the mean and variance? And the answer is yes, if we have additional knowledge, and that's what Bayesian analysis is all about. Now, suppose we wanted to estimate other statistics, such as the median or the mode. There's no straightforward way to measure the error. But there's a way we can actually get at that. Using what are called techniques like jackknifing and bootstrapping. So jackknife and bootstrap techniques are two of the most popular resampling techniques to estimate such statistics. And the general approach we're discussing, resampling, simply means you take your training data set and you take partitions of it. You use some strategy to create partitions so that you can then estimate parameters on those smaller partitions. And then you can look at the bias and the variance of the estimates on these smaller partitions, and you can then use those values to get some estimate of what the bias and variance are of your estimate when you use all of that data. So, for example, a simple approach is what's called the leave one out method. And this is a very simple way to compute the mean, where you compute the mean over all of the data except one. You remove one data point at random and you compute the mean. And then you repeat that process through all n data points, and then you look at the distribution of those means that you compute, and the variance of those means can give you some idea of how your variance is varying as a function of your data set. The jackknife estimate of the mean is then defined as the sum of these estimates from the leave one out method. And the variance of this estimate is then essentially taking the variance of this estimate, it's going to be the actual mean that you compute from the leave one out data set minus the jackknifed estimate of the mean, and then you take that quantity squared and sum it. So this is a way to estimate the bias, to get some sense of how much bias and variance there is in the data itself. This is not necessarily specific to a particular estimation algorithm. So when you do this, this can give you some idea of how adequate your training data set is. Because if your data set is small, for example, obviously leaving one data point out is going to have a significant effect. If your data set is large, leaving one data point out may not have so much of an effect. So we know that as n goes to infinity, these estimators are unbiased, but for finite size data sets, this can be a way to estimate to give you some sense of the adequacy of your sample size. It's also a way of estimating, of getting smoother estimates of your parameters. Because this mean estimate here is the average of n different estimates of the mean rather than just one estimate of the mean. And this approach can be applied to just about any parameter estimate. So we can do this with support vector machines. We could do this with neural networks. You could do this with any kind of a parameter estimation algorithm that you like. It's just a general strategy for resampling your data so that you get you have a way to generate smoothed estimates of your parameters by taking averages over the parameters that you get from these different subsets. So we can write a general estimate for the bias as the true value of the parameter minus the expected value of our estimate. The jackknife method can be used to estimate this bias. The procedure is to delete points one at a time from the data set D and then to compute your average of your parameter from by averaging these estimates that you get from the leave one out set. The jackknife estimate then, the bias in the jackknife estimate is just going to be n minus 1 times the difference between these two estimates, the jackknife estimate and the true, and the estimate that you get when you actually use all of the data. We can rearrange terms and write this as theta tilde is equal to this theta hat, which is the estimate you get from all of the data minus the bias that you get from the jackknife estimate, and we can write this as n times theta hat minus n minus 1 times theta hat sub I. And what we can observe then is as n goes to infinity, these two points converge and the difference of them then goes to 0. So this is an unbiased estimate of the bias. So estimating the bias using this jackknife method is an unbiased estimate of the bias. And remember, the bias is an estimate of the error of your estimation. We can do a similar thing with the variance. We can write that the variance of our estimate is just the expectation of the estimate minus the expectation of the estimate squared. And we can show that the jackknife estimate of the variance is n minus 1 over n times the sum of essentially taking our jackknife estimate of the parameter using the leave one out method this mean computed from the jackknife estimate. And so this is just estimating the variance from our jackknife estimate of the parameter minus the estimates we get from the leave one out method. And this becomes a nice estimate of the variance of your parameters. Now, again, let me provide some context for this. When you run an experiment on one data set with one parameter estimation algorithm and you get a parameter estimate, your tendency is to say, that estimate is better, you know, so you're working on your research and you get this new estimate and you say, well, this new estimate is better than my estimate I got from some previous algorithm. Right? So we've all done this. You have a data set, you have an algorithm, you have a previous algorithm, you're trying to show your algorithm is better than the previous algorithm. You take the data set, you estimate the parameter, and you say, aha, my estimate is closer to the true estimate than previous algorithm, so I'm better. Right? The guys in the back are really struggling. What's wrong with that argument? Okay, so who's working on a research problem that involves some real data? Nobody here is working on any research problem. Okay, so we'll use our classroom example. So we're going to estimate the, we were talking last class about estimating the average, like the distribution of ages of students at Mississippi State. So I'm going to do that by estimating the age of people in this classroom. So I've got five of you here. I use that information to estimate a distribution or estimate the mean age, whatever you want to estimate. And I compare that answer to the estimate I would get if I averaged across all students at Mississippi State. Obviously, the estimate I'm going to get from this class is going to be wrong. That's what we call bias. Okay? I think everyone can understand that. Now, last year, John Smith, a very famous graduate student here, worked on the same problem, and he came up with this really powerful algorithm, he claimed, to estimate the mean from these five people. And the answer he got was 22.3 years old, let's say. And the answer I get today by estimating from the five of you who chose to show up today because it was raining out, I get 22.4, and the true average, let's say, is 22.5. So I say, aha, my estimate is better, because the true answer is 22.5. My algorithm gets 22.4. Last year, John Smith got 22.3. Okay, this is a very common thing. You see this in research groups all the time, right? Now, what's wrong with that argument? And that's why I'm trying to drive this home. What's wrong with that argument? There's many things wrong with that argument. No, we could say we use the same training set. It's just a different algorithm. Okay, that's what we would call bias. But in the context of what we're trying to discuss today, we're trying to discuss another aspect of this same problem. Why is my algorithm better than his? Is my algorithm better than his? The answer is, you can't answer that question until you know something about the statistical significance or the variance of those estimates. I could have just gotten lucky. My algorithm could have some prior information in it. For example, we have 4 out of the 5 students here today are Asian. I could have embedded some knowledge about Asian students' ages in my algorithm. And I could have been lucky. If there were 4 German students in the room, my algorithm could have done worse. The fact that my algorithm beat John Smith's algorithm could have just been luck. It could have just been luck that the particular sample drawn suited my algorithm better than it suited John's algorithm. This is a fundamental concept in this class that that you really need, you know, I really want to drive home. So in this kind of research, when you state your algorithm performance, it's not adequate just to state the performance. You have to talk about either something called the statistical significance, which we've talked about, or you have to talk about the variance of your estimate. Now, it turns out, for sample sets of size 5, in using those sets to estimate the overall population of this university, 5 is a very small number. So the variance of these estimates are going to be very, very large. In fact, the variance of these estimates is going to be so large that, statistically speaking, there's no difference between my estimate of 22.4 and John's estimate of 22.3. The difference is what we call statistical noise. Okay, is that... I hope that's clear. I don't think I can make that any clearer. Now, let's think about this problem in another way. Let's suppose now I'm going to estimate the average from all the people in Simrall right now, at this moment. Simrall, for those of you who are in the distance learning, is the building that we're in. 10 years from now, when someone's listening to the audio on the internet, they'll say, Simrall? What's Simrall? So now I have a larger sample set. There's maybe 200, 300 people in Simrall currently. And we would argue, I think all of us would argue, that the estimate I'm going to get from those 300 people is better than the estimate I'm going to get from these 5 people. But how much better is it? And how can we estimate the bias and the variance that I would get from using that estimate of 300 people? Well, your first, you know, the knee-jerk reaction is, before you took this course, is sort of, I don't know. I can use some basic statistics of sampling theory and such, but I don't really know, because I don't know what the true distribution is. I don't know how representative that sample is. But what we're trying to discuss in this chapter is ways you could take those 300 data, those 300 samples, and actually deduce something about the error or the variance in your process, in your estimation process. And the way we're doing that is by taking subsets of those 300. We could, for example, divide the 300 into 6 sets of 50. 6 disjoint sets of 50, we could estimate parameters on those 50 sets, on those sets of 50 students, and then we could average the estimates across those 6 subsets. That's essentially what jackknifing is. And you can do that, there's a couple reasons you'll do that. One, to get a better estimate of the parameters, but also you can then look at a distribution of your estimates relative to the estimate you would get if you took the... So what you can do then is, we have the jackknife estimate, which is the average. We split the class up into 6. We split the population up into 6 groups of 50. That gives us 6 estimates computed on 50 data points. We then take the average of those estimates, and that's what we call the jackknife estimate. Okay, is everyone clear on that? Then we take those 6 estimates and we compute the variance with respect to the jackknife estimate. So we take, you know, the 6, the sum from 1 to 6. Tell me about the information that we get from doing that. This is all done from this 300 data set. I don't need to know anything about the overall population. I'm deriving information about my estimator just from the data in hand, but I'm inferring more information from that data than you might normally think. What happens, for example, if those six estimates fluctuate significantly? And they will, in fact. If I compute averages, let's say there's six classes going on in this building right now. If I go into each one of those classes and I compute an average age, that estimate's going to vary significantly because some of the classes will be entry-level undergraduate classes where the age will be low. Some of the classes will be higher-level graduate classes where the age will be higher. So I do these six estimates and I observe that there is a significant variation between those six estimates. That tells me something about the variance. That tells me something about the value of my 300 data point sample set, which was the 6 times 50. And I know that if I increase the size of these samples, this variance will go to zero, but that tells me something. Being able to estimate these parameters from subsets of the data, that tells me something about the inherent bias and variance in my estimation algorithm. And that's what jackknifing and bootstrap, and we'll see in a moment, bootstrapping are all about. So a bootstrap data set is one created by randomly selecting endpoints from the training set D with replacement. In bootstrap estimation, this selection process is repeated B times to yield B bootstrap data sets, which are treated as independent sets. The bootstrapped estimate of statistic theta is denoted with this theta star, with this dot superscript, and is merely the mean of the B estimates of the individual bootstrap data sets. So again, you just take endpoints randomly from the training data set D, and then you compute your true parameter as the average of the estimates that you get from those B data sets. The bootstrapped estimate of the bias can be shown, well, it is in fact the difference between your bootstrapped estimate and the estimate you would get if you used all N data points simultaneously. The bootstrapped estimate of the variance is just, you know, the normal, the variance of that same quantity. The bootstrapped estimate of the variance of the mean can be shown to approach the traditional variance of the mean as B goes to infinity. So the more, and this is another interesting point, the more random sets you select, the more you're going to get closer to the true mean of your data. So the larger the number of bootstrap samples, the better the estimate. So if you have a data set D, your initial reaction is, well, maybe I just take all that data together, compute the statistic, like the mean, and use that as my estimate of the mean. Okay? But again, another way to think about this is to take subsets of the data. Let's say you have these 300 data points. Take 50 points at random from those 300. Compute the mean. Take 50 other points. Compute the mean. And repeat that process many, many times. The more you repeat that process, the smaller the variance of your estimate of the mean is going to be. So this is another way of using the data in a resampling mode to improve your estimates of the parameters. This is why when you're working with data sets, with real data sets, you should never just consider one partitioning of the data. You should always look at multiple partitions of the data and do multiple experiments to get some sense of what the variation in your estimate is. So what we've done in this section, these two lectures we've done from lecture that constitute lecture 19, is we introduced the Noth's free lunch theorem, we introduced minimum description length, we discussed bias and variance, And we introduced a class of methods based on resampling techniques. And what we'll do next is to discuss ways to introduce concepts like this into classifier design. So again, the point in this section of the course is not so much a specific learning algorithm, but are there some universal properties of learning algorithms that we can exploit? And the jackknife and bootstrap methods are examples of techniques that are general. You can use those on any algorithm or learning algorithm or classifier approach. They're more a property of the data itself than the particular learning algorithm. Okay, have a good spring break, and I hope you get recharged.